You are listening to Diasporic Music on Black Power 96 with Melinda Francis and Norman Richmond. And we just heard an interview with Angela Y. Davis talking about George Jackson. And we're getting ready to talk to Dr. Gerald Horn, a prolific writer, author, and a podcast. A man is busy since I guess the lockdown. Mr. Horn, every time I look on Facebook, I see a new podcast with him all over the place, from all over the world. And Dr. Horn is, I guess we want to ask you, I guess the first question is, could you give us your thoughts on Black August? This is Black August, and we've been paying tribute to Black August. Let me say this. I remember you saying many years ago that, you know, the whole question of Black History Month, you know, people talked about Black History Month being updated. And you were saying, I guess you probably continue to say that the prisoners took Black History Month to the next level. And now we have Black August, which is the, I guess, the radical side of the Black tradition. Am I correct in saying that?
Well, certainly, I think there's something to what you say. And I have to say, I participate in both. I remember one time, like a year or so ago, for some reason, the Pacifica Station in Berkeley invited me on to talk about Black History Month in February. And they wanted me to get involved in a trashing of Black History Month, which I refused to do because I think it serves a purpose, just like Black August serves a purpose. And the focus on Black August tends to focus on these pivotal events in our history that have some connection to August. For example, the killing of Black Panther Party founder Huey P. Newton took place in August 1989. I still remember
right.
where I was in Santa Barbara, California, when I heard the stunning and staggering news, and the Watts Revolt August 1965 in Los Angeles, which had a transformative impact on Black consciousness, Black politics, U.S. politics, the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, which helps to ignite a general crisis of the entire slave system that could only be resolved with its collapse. So there are many reasons why Black August is worthy of note and should be marked in August 2020.
Well, let me say that before you go on. Remember, Amil Carker Brawl talked about the Watts Rebellion. He talked about that among, they were having a group of nationalist leaders. I think it was in 66 or 65, and Amil Carker Brawl specifically called out the Watts Rebellion in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. I never will forget that as long as I live.
That's remarkable. You should write about it.
Yes, sir. And had you finished on the Black August situation?
Yeah, I think we can move on because we'll be tackling it again, I'm sure, during this epical month of August 2020.
I guess the question, the most burning question, is the COVID-19 is a burning question, but how would you relate the question of sports in the COVID-19 situation? I think we had we've had a couple of basketball games, and I think LeBron's team prevailed over Kawhi's team. The Lakers prevailed over the LA Clippers. Could you talk about sports and COVID-19?
Well, what I really find concerning is the attempt to have a college football season in the United States. And I say that not only because it puts these mostly Black young men in jeopardy, but also as of today, they're going to be in jeopardy without even getting paid. Whereas at least the professional athletes get paid handsome salaries to go on the basketball court, to go on the gridiron, to go on the baseball diamond. And speaking of the latter, the baseball diamond, I found it striking that the Canadians basically barred the Toronto Blue Jays, as I understand it, from playing in Toronto, and they're going to be playing in Buffalo, New York. And I guess because they didn't want all these diseased Yankees crossing the border, spreading the coronavirus throughout Canada, which is a remarkable turn of events for those who carry the blue passport, who often saw it as sort of, for a U.S. passport holder, a sort of open sesame. That is to say, the rivers would part as you entered any particular country. But now the worm has turned, the tables have turned, and the blue U.S. passport is no longer a magic document. But in any case, I find it concerning that these sports are going forward, particularly in these hot spots like Florida, for example. My opinion of holding professional or any kind of sports in Florida is that basically they must be holding these games in Florida because they couldn't find a leper colony. Because it would probably be safer to hold the game in a leper colony, you know, have it in Florida.
Which That's right.
is a reflection of the really incompetent leadership of the U.S. administration, which has led to economic numbers not seen since the Great Depression of the 1930s. And yet, with all that, one cannot say with certainty that Donald J. Trump will be defeated in November 2020, which is probably the most remarkable aspect of all. And if that's not remarkable, what's similarly concerning is the fact that many of our analysts on the left, they continue to agree with the one-time left-leaning union leader, speaking of Ronald Wilson Reagan, the U.S. president as of 1980, who said that he didn't leave the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party left him. And what he meant was that the Democratic Party turned to the left and that he didn't want to turn to the left. And what's interesting, many analysts on the left, they have a similar sort of analysis, although with a different twist. They say that the Euro-Americans in the middle class and working class, they began to turn away from the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party did not turn to the left. But of course, they leave the black community out of their discussion because they cannot explain why the black working class and middle class did not begin to vote for the Republican Party when their Euro-American counterparts did so. And because they ignored the black community, it makes many black people feel that they're engaged in a cover-up for white supremacy, or they don't know what they're talking about, or worse, that they might be closet white supremacists themselves.
Oh, yep. Melinda, you had a question?
Do we want to talk about Libya?
Well, yeah, I think we do, because as we speak, there is a brewing crisis in Libya. For those who do not recall that in the spring of 2011, in the midst of what was optimistically termed the Arab Spring, the 44th U.S. President, Mr. Obama, and his NATO allies engaged in a bombing campaign to drive the longtime, long-term leader, Muammar Gaddafi, out of office. And that also led to his assassination. Now, what made me begin to think more about Libya was an article in the press here in Behind the Cotton Curtain, where it was suggested that Mr. Obama's having trouble completing his memoirs. And I speculate it is because he can't think of a good explanation for this Libya fiasco, not least since the head of the Pentagon, who was a Republican Party holdover, speaking of Bob Gates, a former leader of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency as well, was opposed to the Libyan misadventure. But Mr. Obama chose to follow the advice of the Troika, led by Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, UN Ambassador Samantha Power, and National Security Ambassador Susan Rice, who's now being touted as a vice presidential nominee with Mr. Biden. But it's more troubling is the disturbing reports about the torture and murder of darker-skinned Libyans and darker-skinned Africans who wander into Libya, the fact that Libya has descended into chaos and has become a gateway for people trying to escape drowning in the Mediterranean or being penalized and pulverized once they reach Malta or the southern tip of Italy. And it's also striking that recently the parliament in Egypt debated a resolution as to whether they should invade, the Egyptian military should invade Libya to restore a kind of order, which could lead to the conflict spreading into Egypt itself. The only good news there is that the Egyptian focus on Libya distracts Cairo from its conflict with Ethiopia about Ethiopia building a dam on the Nile River, which Cairo charges is jeopardizing the lifeblood of Egypt, which is the Nile River. So in any case, this Libya misadventure has been a fiasco. And then recall as well that in the aftermath of the overthrow of Gaddafi, you had tons of weapons that leaked out of Libya into neighboring Mali, which were then grabbed by religious zealots who declared that they are Muslims. And this led to destabilizing of neighboring Mali. And what's happening is that the trouble in Mali is now spreading into the neighborhood, bidding fair to help to shake the foundations of neighboring states like Cote d'Ivoire. It's already helped to weaken the government in Burkina Faso. It could also weaken the government in Ghana. So this Libya misadventure has been a fiasco. And I was thinking after I read the news that Zimbabwe in Southern Africa was forced to, at least on paper, a pledge to pay reparations to the European farmers whose
yep.
land was expropriated by the late leader Robert Mugabe. It's unclear if they'll actually get paid, but it was quite stunning to see this picture of these European farmers sitting at the table signing documents agreeing to get paid and compensated. Now, what's interesting is that I was listening to a national public radio, a talk show.
NPR.
Hosted by Jen White, a Black woman from Chicago. And it's interesting because when they put Black people in these positions, oftentimes they feel they have to toe the line. And so she asked one of the Euro-American guests on this program a question that her bosses might consider to be an exercise in mischief. She asked, is it true that the European farmers are receiving reparations from Zimbabwe? And of course, the person who was slotted to answer the question stumbled and stammered and stuttered, taken aback. But in a sense, that's what's taking place. But even more troubling is that a number of Black organizations and individuals who I will not name and shame, I will not share their names to protect the guilty, were in the forefront of clamoring against Mugabe, clamoring against ZANU-PF, going along with this narrative that this was a human rights disaster, what was taking place in Zimbabwe, basically co-signing what Desmond Tutu, the religious leader from South Africa, had suggested when he said that there should be an invasion of Zimbabwe to topple Mugabe, something that then British Prime Minister Tony Blair was seriously considering. He was turned down by Thabo Mbeki, the then leader of South Africa, succeeding Nelson Mandela, which then led to a backlash against Thabo, which helped to drive him from office. And so after contemplating Libya and the response of the Black community, which either was quiet or supportive of Libya, not in toto, but in large numbers. And then after contemplating what's just taking place in Zimbabwe with, quote, reparations, unquote, being paid or in the process of being paid, perhaps, to these European farmers, which, of course, will serve as a setback for descendants of enslaved Africans getting reparations, because it creates a political atmosphere that makes that more problematic. I was beginning to move to a position that I'm reluctant to adhere to, which is that maybe many of these Black Americans should just be quiet about Africa until they get their act together, because actually these Black Americans are contributing to disasters and catastrophes for whatever reason. Maybe it's ignorance, maybe it's bad politics, but in any case, it's a damn shame.
Yeah, I remember getting into trouble myself because I was among the set of people who was born in America that supported Robert Mugabe, and we were dogged from especially from the white left. Oh my God, Mugabe was he wasn't a Marxist. He was a Christian. He was a dictator. He didn't like. I mean, they call Robert Gabriel Mugabe everything but a child of Jah. You know, they talked about him like a dog. And remember when he came to Toronto, he spoke at the University of Toronto. And I remember a dear friend of mine, whose name I won't call, jumped up and tried to shout Mugabe down. But Mugabe had... His security was sisters, a Zimbabwean women who had been trained by the North Koreans. What was the name of it? They had there was a certain section of people that were trained by the North Koreans. Maurice Bishop had a relationship, not Maurice Bishop, but the government of Maurice Bishop. They had a relationship with these same forces. And so this sister was a very dear friend of mine. She was foaming at the mouth and, you know, Mugabe was cool as a cucumber, and she was yelling and screaming, and Mugabe raised his voice and kept on going. And I never will forget that as long as I live.
Yeah, it's very unfortunate. I mean, I think, you know, it's we can't dig ourselves out of this hole in which we find ourselves until we begin to build international relationships. I'm speaking of Black Americans in the first instance. And it's hard to build international relationships when people in the international community see many of our personalities and organizations collaborating with U.S. imperialism. That's not the way to build alliances and to build camaraderie.
Yeah, but don't you think that they've scared people so much in terms of the radical. Well, I think I've heard you say many times that the right wing of well, say the civil rights movement supported the break, whereas the Black Power movement, many sectors of the Black Power movement went the other way. But our traditional leadership, NAACP, Urban League, and people like that, basically bought the line to be anti-communist, which is why we're in the situation we're in now. I think you've said that many times.
Well, that's true, but I don't want to let anybody off the hook, because as you know, one of your former comrades in Ontario, who is now residing in the United States of America and has Jamaican roots, has been one of the major problems that I'm referring to. And I'm sure he would consider himself part of the Black Power movement. I'll never forget when I was in Zimbabwe about a decade ago, I was trying to give a lecture on the U.S. and Zimbabwe, U.S. and Africa from the slave trade to Bush. It was during the Bush regime. And folks, because of that title, and many at the university did not even want to give me a platform. And so I had to have it at a local think tank. And I'll never forget walking down the street of Harare, listening to the BBC, and this, quote, gentleman, unquote, I was just making reference to, simultaneously was on the BBC denouncing what was going on in Zimbabwe, when I couldn't even get a platform to speak in Zimbabwe. So there you have it.
Well, that individual that you're speaking about, whose name will remain... yeah, he's never been a fan of mine. He always every opportunity he gets, he will say he's not a fan of mine, but feeling is mutual. But could we move on to talk about Karen Bass? Now, Karen Bass is a California, Los Angeles, California a person that may be considered maybe Joe Biden's running mate to be the vice president. Now, she has a history of being very progressive, but recently she has denounced Cuba. She is walking back her comments praising Comrade Fidel Castro, and she it reminds me in 1984 when Jesse Lewis Jackson was running for president. In 1984, when he came out of the box, he was almost sounding like Gerald Horn in terms of when he had all the 14 candidates, the 15 candidates. I mean, Jesse was the most progressive on the platform, but by the time he was trying to get the nomination, he had toned down his rhetoric so much where he sounded like a porch mouse, a church mouse. And am I correct in saying the same thing is happening with Karen Bass, who's trying to become, who's being considered to be Joe Biden's running mate for president?
Well, I think it could be called the price of power. Because this is such a right-wing country, particularly amongst the Euro-American population across class lines, so those who try to go as Karen Bass is trying to do from a mostly black district in Los Angeles, which she represents in Congress, to a higher stage, she's being forced, or she feels that she has to curb some of her former positions, such as Karen Bass was a leader of the Vincent Ramos Brigade, the folks in the United States who would go to Cuba every year to cut sugar cane, build houses. I mean, I've had exchanges with Karen. Matter of fact, I've been looking for the email, because the last exchange I had with her, she was reprimanding and rebuking me from the left, citing Mao Zedong. All people, if you reprimanded me. And so I'm not sure if this recent move by Karen Bass will work. Margaret Kimberly, a Black Agenda report, calls it inefficient opportunism, because she doesn't feel that Karen will get this vice presidential nomination and therefore will have repudiated the Cubans for nothing.
Right.
So I have to say, I mean, that's really a backline. Go to Breitbart News, Breitbart News, which Steve Bannon, Mr. Trump's former guru, used to work for and still has a relationship with. They have a detailed takedown of all her left-wing connections, mentioning a lot of people I know, I mean, for example. Which I didn't know. She had such close relationship with the late O'Neill Cannon, who was the longtime, long-term leader of the Southern California Communist Party, for example, who started the Paul Robeson Center out in South Los Angeles, right off Vermont. Vermont and 61st. I didn't know she was close to O'Neill Cannon. So I'm only mentioning it because, you know, it's all over the internet. So I don't know. I'll be very surprised if she can overcome these exposés.
I think Melinda had a question.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys saw, but they killed Kamala Harris as a possible running mate. They've been talking that through, like the Telegraph, the CNN, still talking about Kamala Harris as a running mate.
Well, I think there's something to that. I think it's because, you know, she ran for president and therefore she has national name recognition, and she had a reputation as San Francisco DA and California Attorney General, her previous positions, as being tough on crime, which in some ways is translated to being tough on the Negroes. But actually,
I said this on George Galloway's show on Radio Sputnik a few weeks ago, and I suggested that if Kamala does get the nomination, it may not necessarily be because of the African half of her ancestry, but the South Asian half of her ancestry, because
right.
U.S. imperialism is rather hysterical about China right now. I think on our agenda is to talk about the recent speech by Secretary of State Michael Pompeo, where he basically calls for regime change in China, which is breathtaking if you think about it for more than a nanosecond. And in order to encircle China, they'll need India to be on board. And I think that if Kamala Harris is the nominee and Mr. Biden wins in November, that she'll be on a U.S. jet to New Delhi by February to confer with the Indian leadership under Kul Modi, the prime minister. And I think that, in other words, that could fit into the strategic calculus of the Biden wing of the U.S. ruling class.
But don't you think Kamala Harris plays every card she can? I mean, I've heard her on the Breakfast Club. You know, she will come out and be singing, "You want the funk?" You know, she'll sound like she'll be bow wow wow yippee yo yippee yay and bragging about smoking herb, and then the next minute she'll go into her Brahmin Indian thing, and then you know, she'll talk about her, well, the fact that she did do a number on the Negroes when she was the Attorney General. What I'm trying to say is she's a very good opportunist, don't you think?
Well, I think that she's a U.S. politician. I would look at her the way I look at
yeah, okay. No retort on that. You're right. Yeah.
I mean, you know, this is what
you got to do.
Politicians in the United States do to climb the greasy pole of success. I mean, look yes, at sir. Joe Biden. I mean, here's a guy who not so long ago was praising segregationists, who was opposing busing. Recall that Kamala busted him for opposing busing, who was basically on the right wing of the Democratic Party for most of his career. And now, since black voters bailed him out in South Carolina and revived his flagging candidacy, he sounded like Bernie Sanders. I mean, you know, this is what these U.S. politicians do, which is one of the reasons why they're so untrustworthy and one of the reasons why it's difficult for them to build lasting coalitions.
I guess we have a few minutes left. Could you talk about Senator Tom Cotton Picking?
Well, Mr. Cotton, a senator from Arkansas, just introduced legislation that would seek to cut federal funding, Washington funding, to any school district, of which there are thousands in this country, that would use the so-called 1619 Project, which listeners may recall, in some ways draws upon my work by the architect's own admission, my work with regard to slavery being a motive force for the founding of the United States in the first place. But if you read the legislation carefully, this legislation, if it passes, would also seek to cut funding to any school district that tries to teach an accurate history of slavery. In other words, you have to do a cover-up of slavery in order to get federal funding, according to Mr. Cotton. And even more concerning, perhaps, is that in the context of justifying this legislation, he said that slavery, mass enslavement of Africans, was a necessary evil to build the United States of America. And so, in some senses, that made it justifiable. Well, this is staggering, but in some ways, an unmasked. Other supporters of this idea that this 1776 so-called revolution was a great leap forward for humanity, even though it tightened the chains of slavery, even though it led to further enslavement of other Africans, because in many ways, he just made explicit what these other folks are saying implicitly. They're saying with a soft voice that yes, although they don't say it clearly, that yes, it was a necessary evil because it led to this bourgeois democracy and the Bill of Rights and all that. He just came out with it. He said that, you know, you Negroes had to be slaves so that other people could gain rights. And this is, I have to say, it's breathtaking.
Yeah, that's so
crazy. Any other questions you have, Melinda? Because I guess we have to shut him down.
No, I think we can leave it to the next week.
All right, Dr. Ho, last question that I have for you is, are there any activities that you know that are going to be taking place around Black August or Emancipation Day? And I guess we don't, Emancipation Day is, that's a divide between those Africans that were colonized by the Yankees and those Africans that were colonized by the British, or would you say that?
Oh yeah, that's a fair assessment. I know August 1st, yesterday, is routinely marked in the British Caribbean, so-called. They're going to be, I'm just, you know, like I said, I'm doing all these podcasts, all these broadcasts, right, and too many to mention. Although the aftermath usually show up on my Facebook page.
That's a Horn Report. Yeah, I will. Yeah, that. I'll put that on my Facebook page and advertise it as soon as we get off the air.
Good.
So thank you very much, Comrade Gerald Horn. We will see you next week.
Good luck.
Take care. And you have been listening to Diasporic Music. And any final thoughts, Melinda Francis?
See you in the whirlwind.
All right, we will take care.